Well, like it or not, cars will soon be driving themselves all over the United States. And while many new vehicles already have some autonomous features, a new Moody's report predicts fully driverless cars could be common by 2030, standard on all new vehicles by 2035, and have near universal adoption by 2055. Well, our big question debate is for today is, are these self-driving cars good or bad for America? We have two guests who will be taking opposing viewpoints during our big question. And you can also weigh in on the big question poll, which I'll talk about in just a moment. First, I want to introduce my guest. Robin Washington is a transportation journalist and columnist whose work appears in the Boston Globe and other publications. His website is robinwashington.com. Robin Washington, good morning. Welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And also joining us this morning is Michael Klaman, a senior research scientist at Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. He leads Duke's driverless car research. Michael Klaman, welcome to the Joy Cardine Show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So before we get into this, I want to mention our online poll. You can find a link to this at the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or at WPR.org. A new Moody's Investor Service report, which we just referenced, said that fully autonomous cars could be common in the U.S. by 2030. So how do you feel about self-driving cars? One, I'm excited. They'll be safer and more convenient. Two, I'm worried technology can fail. Or three, I'm pretty middle of the road. So participate in our poll. We'll announce the results at the end of the hour. All right, Robin, since you strongly support the driverless car, let's start with you and get your opening statement. Why will we be better off with autonomous vehicles?
Ooh, I don't know. I strongly support. I am a journalist, so of course I'm officially non-biased here. But the future is happening, and I don't think we can or should stop it. So I don't think we should stand in this way by any means. And I think the single reason you would support this, anybody would support this, is safety, which I'm sure Michael, by the way, will have arguments against it based also on safety, too. But the bottom line is autonomous cars, when they're perfected, and I think we both will talk about that goal of being perfected, would dramatically decrease the number of accidents. There's just no question that human error is something that's more responsible for accidents than anything else. We know about distracted driving and all. And so if you take away that factor, it's going to be better, or it should be better, again, with the caveat that all the other bugs have to be worked out.
Michael, you're not necessarily dead set against driverless cars, but you do have some concerns. In your opening statement, and we'll get into deeper detail as we go along, what are your hang-ups about autonomous vehicles?
Yeah, you're correct in saying that. I think, you know, if they live up to expectations, that having driverless cars would be a fantastic thing. You know, it is true that 90% of accidents are due to so-called human error. But the issue that I have, you know, despite these advantages, is that between where we have the technology right now and this, and having fully autonomous cars on the road, it's too big a leap from where we are right now to be able to know when that's actually going to happen.
And Michael, one of your concerns among your team at Duke is a lack of evidence-based tests and evaluation. What do you mean by that?
What that means, right now, you have the companies that are building these cars are generally following a software development model with their tests. So, for example, the most famous one is going to be Google, where ever since they've been testing their cars since 2010, they've been driving their cars around well-mapped circuits within the Bay Area. So over there, you've got good weather, well-marked infrastructure, known roads, basically going through this repeatedly. With what we're advocating is to test these a little bit harder. So rather than basically repeatedly doing these things, basically try to make them fail. So in the scientific method, which is what we support, rather than, you know, finding this golden path that you have the car follow correctly each time and look for alterations, basically try to do something that challenges the vehicle a bit more, see what makes it fail, and then fix that and continue to iterate along that path.
Robin, these cars, as you said in your opening statement, are a work in progress. How satisfied have you been with the level of testing at this point? Has it been aggressive and thorough enough?
Well, I think it's enthusiastic is a good way of putting it. I have not seen the auto industry so much embrace something like this. I mean, everybody is doing this. I was at the New York Auto Show last week. It's still going on. And practically every car there has some sort of a semi-autonomous feature. I mean, it's almost standard to, in fact, the mini cars, they are standard, and not very expensive cars, too. I'll get to that in a second. But to have adaptive cruise control, which means you follow the person in front of you and your car will automatically react to what they do, that has lane assist that keeps you in the lane, that has automatic or collision avoiding braking that stops the car when it sees an obstacle coming up. And then there's things like self-parking, which actually does all of this at once. So basically what you're talking about is steering, is accelerating and stopping, and those are the main functions of course, driving a car. One more, by the way, Cadillac, the latest edition, has a night vision system that I sat in this thing and you could see in front of you, and it has something like 100 yards infrared sensor in front of you that will show you deer darting in front of the highway. We didn't have any deer at the show. We had showgoers, but they showed up quite vividly. So the whole thing that I've heard people question, well, what about somebody running in the street or something like that? That's coming up, too. The sensor, by the way, tells you it's there. This one isn't programmed to stop the car, but it could easily be so.
800-642-1234, the number to call to join the program, 800-642-1234. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And you can also weigh in on this big question on Facebook. Look for the Joy Cardine Show. We have an email from Brandon. Brandon says, I am eagerly awaiting this development. I drive all day for my job. It is very tedious. I often get highway hypnosis and drowsy driving. I could just tell it where to go and then snooze. For me, it sounds fantastic. Well, it does sound like a real innovation if we didn't have to worry about, especially if we're on long drives and long commutes, falling asleep. Michael, what do you think about this? I mean, it's going to be a very popular idea. How can we make it safe?
It certainly is. It's a great idea, and that's one of the big ones. I mean, with drowsy driving, distracted driving, drunk driving, you know, having autonomous cars would, you know, if deployed fully, those would definitely solve those problems. But again, the issue here is this transition between where we have cars today and this fully autonomous option. Now, Robin was just talking about some of these advanced features that you're seeing being deployed in cars right now. And even at the point now, I think it was just a couple weeks ago, that Honda announced that they're going to be putting some of these features in their Civic at a $20,000 price point, which is fantastic. So some of these are going to be available to people,
right,
you know, who can't afford a Tesla. But what we're talking about is cars at that level are fulfilling some fairly simple control tasks. So basically holding the wheel in a straight line, watching the side of the road for the white lines, and being able to maintain a safe distance behind the car in front of it. So those are fairly simple tasks, basically, you know, if-then statements, being able to react to the stimulus. Where the complexity comes in with autonomous cars is being able to make choices in new situations. Basically, unless the driverless car has seen the situation before, it is difficult to know how the car would assess that situation in the future. And that's one of the things that's fairly challenging. So right now, there's still a requirement that if you're drowsy behind the wheel, you shouldn't be driving. And that's even with these so-called semi-autonomous features. And again, the issue here is that it's difficult to be able to see how we're going to make this transition suddenly from these semi-autonomous vehicles, which require a human to be behind the wheel of the car, to this day where we just stop stop being behind the wheel and stop being able to make those decisions in emergency situations.
Robin, quickly to you before we go to the news. Technology is great when it works, but anyone who knows who has owned a computer knows that it also fails. Okay, the computer crashes at home, we get the blue screen, but when a car crashes, it's a whole different level. Robin, are we putting too much faith in a machine?
We would be if we went to it tomorrow. So I totally agree with Michael that it's not there yet, and you have these semi-autonomous options or features that don't automatically become autonomous tomorrow. So the way, very quickly, it would work is you would take something like your HOV lane in a highway, and you would say, okay, this will be driverless, and then you take one lane and then a second one while you have all the technological improvements and bugs get worked out. So it's not something that you just turn on tomorrow. And you need all sorts of regulations change, all sorts of highway markings, everything we know, really, on the road to change for this to happen. But
all right.
I'm glad Michael mentioned the Civic, because that's the cheap car I was talking about.
Okay. We're going to take a break and catch some news, and then we'll be back with more of our big question, driverless cars, good idea or not? Weigh in on our online poll. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. It's our big question debate. We're talking about driverless cars and wondering what you think about them. 800-642-1234. Talk at WPR.org or find the Joy Cardine Show on Facebook. You can also participate in our Facebook poll on driverless cars and let us know how you feel about them. Are you excited because they'll be safer and more convenient? Are you worried because technology can fail, or you really don't have an opinion? Weigh in on our poll. We'll release the results at the end. Let me reintroduce my two guests. Robin Washington is a transportation journalist and columnist whose work appears in the Boston Globe and other publications. His website is robinwashington.com. He's speaking in favor of driverless cars with some caveats. Michael Klaman is a senior research scientist at Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. He leads Duke's driverless car research. And he's got some concerns about driverless cars, and we're talking about those with our two guests and with our listeners, should you decide to participate. We were talking about technology just before the break. Michael, do you think that you'll ever feel comfortable going for a ride knowing that a computer is making all the decisions with no human input?
I'd like to have a really good idea of how that computer works before I'm willing to do that. I would certainly be comfortable in the scenario that Robin mentioned before. If there was a dedicated lane on the highway to do that, then I would certainly feel comfortable doing that. But I would need to know a lot more about how they function before I'd be comfortable riding a driverless car.
Robin, what about you? Do you think you would feel comfortable in a car knowing that you have no control over it?
Hey, I think you found a point where Michael and I can actually have a point-counterpoint, because we have all these caveats where we say, well, we kind of agree, but... okay, here's the analogy I want to make, which is 75 years ago, would you get into an elevator that did not have an elevator operator?
Well, we do all the time.
We do all the time today. In fact, I know your elevator is in the Madison offices of Wisconsin Public Radio. You have an empty shaft that pretends to be an elevator.
There's a story behind that, but we won't get into it now.
Fully automated. We don't think anything of it. And it doesn't matter if you're going up one floor or 100 floors or whatever. An elevator is something that we've taken for granted. It works, it's there and everything. That doesn't mean, by the way, it's inherently safe. You could have an elevator accident, and they do happen, that goes down five floors, and that's fatal. So you don't even have to get to the Empire State Building or the Sears Tower. So the point I'm making here is, you know, there are we do need to get past irrational fears. I mean, I'm totally, again, with all the caveats here, with Michael, that it's something totally different to be in a car in a whole spatial environment where you go left, right, and even up and down and stuff. And there's a lot more variables than you have to an elevator. But if you look 75, 100 years ago, this was something that there was no way you would think of doing this without a human being attached to it. The other part, by the way, is we get into airplanes every day. Autopilot is the majority of that flight. In Minneapolis and St. Paul Airport, I'm sure, have taken the tram. that's a driverless train, we think nothing of it. So, you know, there we shouldn't be afraid of it just because it's driverless, because we're used to something else. But going back to the caveats, with all the bug work, though, with all the possible scenarios that we can think of addressed, you know, this should be something that within 10, and that, by the way, I think it would be sooner than 20 years, but 10, certainly 20 years, we'll be beginning to take for granted.
Another point is the FBI and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration issued a bulletin earlier this month warning that vehicles are increasingly vulnerable to hacking. Michael, how worried are you about that happening to driverless cars?
Somewhat concerned, yeah. The main area where we're concerned with hacking driverless cars is in the area of GPS spoofing, where essentially you're getting, when you the way these cars are going to navigate is through GPS signals, the same way, you know, you would navigate now using maps, except rather than it going to, you know, your GPS map that you use to navigate, it goes directly to the car and it helps you get from point A to point B. Well, it's possible to transmit false signals to this to your GPS, or block it entirely, which would either make it so the car doesn't know where it is anymore, or would make it that the car thinks it's in a different place. And so, in theory, it's possible to, by transmitting a false signal, you could make these driverless cars go anywhere you want them to go. And it's still an emerging area of research of how cars are even going to figure out if they've been hacked in that respect and be able to have some kind of countermeasure to that. So at the moment, there's really no solution for GPS spoofing.
Well, and anybody who's ever navigated with GPS on their smartphone or in a one of those GPS units you buy and put on the dashboard of your car, you know that the coordinates for an address aren't always accurate. Addresses are often kind of funny, and I lived in a house for a number of years that the GPS had placed three blocks in a different direction. So, you know, there is that as well. Let's take a quick call. Craig is with us from Onalaska, and I'd like to get to Craig's point on the air here. There we go. Craig, go ahead.
Good morning. My question is, on the way to work this morning, I was driving the speed limit, and I had any number of cars pass me. So my question is, are these cars going to be driving only this up to the speed limit?
Oh, great question. Robin, do you know, are these going to be programmed to follow all of the speed laws?
Why, of course. They'll follow every law that there is. Again, that's an interesting point, because what did I say about adaptive cruise control? One of the points of it is safety. So if it's responding to the person in front or behind you or something like that, and that person is going 90 miles per hour, I don't think you're supposed to go 90 miles per hour, but on the other hand, everybody knows that there are times you've been on the highway that if you went the exact speed limit, it would not be safe.
Mm-hmm. You know what? Let's take another call, since we have some people who want to join the show here. 800-642-1234, if you'd like to be on. John in Madison, you'll be next. John, hello.
Hi. Well, the average pilot only actually flies a plane now for 17 minutes. The rest of the time, it's autopilot. And I understand these cars are doing very well out in California. I heard the earlier caveats regarding the test that for 2 years they performed in an exemplary fashion as far as accidents and deaths go. My question, though, in the future, assuming they get all the bugs out of this, is it seems like it would be mandatory that everybody participates, so you wouldn't have these errant speeders or human billiard balls driving around. And the other question is whether you could get in the car and be drunk or on drugs. In other words, anticipating that perhaps you'd have to take over if there was a malfunction. But what the thing I'd really like you also to comment about is what this portends for the human participation in the trucking and taxi industries. It seems like we would markedly reduce highway patrol participation, reduce insurance premiums, car insurance premiums, and it would be a boon for tavern owners. So I wonder if you could talk about all these possibilities.
Wow, a lot to chew on there. Robin, why don't you go first, and then I would also like to hear from Michael on this.
There were a whole bunch there, but one that I would totally agree with is say goodbye to auto insurance. And I don't know if I'm supposed to give investment advice, but if you have stocks in auto insurance, I would think twice about that. I mean, the point is, once these cars are out there, and by the way, There's one scenario in which they will not be owned by you, because the whole point is a car picks up John, takes him to Wisconsin Public Radio, then goes and gets me, and then goes and gets Michael, whatever. The point is, these things are in constant motion. They rarely park. So they'll probably be owned by Google, hopes it's going to be Google. Uber thinks that Uber is going to own these things. And the manufacturers are getting into the idea of actually leasing cars to multiple people. So because of that, it's going to totally change our whole idea of what a car is, whether you own it or not. So I bring up the auto insurance because if that happens, Uber or Google or, you know, Lexus is not necessarily going to be paying State Farm. They'll probably self-insure. Secondly, the incidence of accidents is going to be way lower. So even if there is auto insurance, the premiums for that should go down tremendously. You had so many other things in there.
Well, would it be mandatory? Would it be mandatory? And then the other one will you be able? Will you be allowed to get into a car if you're intoxicated? But would this have to be mandatory in order to work, do you think?
So, that's where we're getting into a lot of the concerns that Michael raises, and I'm raising too, of regulation. I mean, so many laws absolutely have to change. First of all, a law that would say that you don't have to have a human being driving a car. That's number one. Certainly that you're, I think there's laws actually saying that you have to have at least one hand on the steering wheel, right? So if the whole idea is you get in the car because you have been out drinking, and that's a great thing that you have something that's going to be safe and drive you. But it's a semi-autonomous, or it's autonomous to a point that it does want a human being to take over and you're not able to, I think you're responsible at that point. And I don't know if this insurance is going to cover you or not. So that's a regulatory issue that has to be looked at. One main point about this is I'm terribly excited about all the manufacturers really in an arms race to figure this out, to do this, to put this out there. But at some point, they've got to come together, and there has to be, again, regulation, government laws entirely changed. Different states are all at different places. I know Arizona's a little bit ahead of some, but Minnesota is kind of behind. And so I'll quickly have an analogy to something that happened in transportation, again, about 75 years ago or more, which was competing streetcar companies all were coming up with streetcar designs, and none of them were compatible. Finally, the presidents of these companies created something called a President's Conference Committee and invented the PCC streetcar, which lasted for, actually is still in use today in many places. So they came up with one design that decided to do this. I don't know if this is a cartel or not, but the point is the technology got consistent, and that's what's got to happen.
Well, Michael Klaman, I wanted to get you in on this as well. Are we moving too fast? I mean, Robin talks about an arms race between auto manufacturers. Do you think we're moving too quickly in this direction?
Somewhat, yeah. I think there's definitely a rush. All the auto manufacturers, they want to be the first to deploy their products, and therefore, have the best handhold on the market. And in doing that, that's exactly what we're seeing. And one of the main concerns of the various manufacturers of autonomous cars is that there's this patchwork now of state regulations that, as you go from, California and Nevada, Washington, D.C., which are very open to it, and then places, like Wisconsin and North Carolina, where there are some barriers to autonomous cars. And so what the manufacturers would like to do is just remove those barriers. And that way you're not, obviously these cars are going to be driving from one state to another, and you don't want to have to go from one state, cross the border, and then have a different regulation once you get to the next state. So they would like to have as few of these barriers as possible to doing this. The downside is that as responsible as these companies, may be in, their due diligence as far as, privacy concerns, safety concerns, the amount of rigor that goes into the software design of these things, we don't know if, the next startup coming up next week is going to apply those same high standards. And so there should be some level of regulations in place that have, certain standards for safety and performance for these vehicles.
What about the 3 million people who currently drive trucks and cabs and buses for a living? What happens to them, Robin Washington?
Well, By the way, one starting with trucks, the Army actually is a, I don't know if they're quite doing this yet, but they're prepared to do this, implement driverless technology, or I should say autonomous, because it isn't necessarily driverless, there's actually going to be a person there, in military convoys. So what happens is you're basically taking your adaptive cruise control, and you have one guy in the front truck leading the convoy, and the others are all programmed to follow him. So it's like a train, if you will, and obviously, you know, you save on all kinds of people there. But saving on people there means somebody's job. That's exactly what you were talking about. And in the ultimate Uber vision of the world where, you know, everything is a driverless car that picks you up, and again, it's owned by Uber or whoever. The Uber president actually has called it, CEO has called it Uber without the dude. And I don't think the dudes are too happy about that. These are the guys, of course, who displace taxi drivers, so they're not going to get a lot of sympathy, but the bottom line is they're not going to be there. I mean, you're not going to need them.
Let's take a call from Scott in New Glarus next. Scott, hello. You're on the Joy Cardine Show.
Yes. The previous hour on the show, they talked a lot about amphibians crossing the road, frogs, turtles. I'm wondering if these cars would be programmed to avoid hitting those amphibians in the road.
Well, I don't know. Where's the technology on animals crossing the road? Michael Klaman, do you know anything about this? And I know, Robin, you probably got some insights here, too, but we'll go to Michael first.
Yeah, this is going to vary from manufacturer to manufacturer. The main thing that they've programmed in is a hierarchy of safety features. And if something wanders out into the road, then the car will stop if it's possible within the space required, unless it's going to compromise the safety of a person within the vehicle or external to the vehicle. So, yeah, unfortunately, an animal, depending on the size, could be sacrificed to protect the safety of the driver.
And I actually mentioned that earlier when I talked about the Cadillac with the night vision system mm-hmm. and the infrared. It could detect a deer. It could detect me, you, warm-blooded creatures. I'm wondering about cold-blooded because it's infrared. So I don't know, you know, what kind of signal that, or wavelength that they emit. But the other part about that, by the way, is I'm not as much concerned about something darting in front of the road because I think that that could be handled through various technology. Here's the problem. If you have a child at the side of the road and the ball rolls into the street, any human being who's paying attention knows that's a problem and you've got to stop. That's where the car, the computer, again, unless, as Michael says, it has the experience, it's learned, or it's been programmed, isn't going to know that. The kid has not run into the street, so at that point, it's not an obstacle. But you and I know the kid is going to run into the street.
Let's try and get one more caller in before the next news break. Melissa is with us from Wausau. Melissa, go ahead.
Good morning. I was just curious how these vehicles are going to handle inclement weather. You know, these vehicles may be fine in California, Florida, Texas, but in Wisconsin, we get snow, ice. And if these vehicles are traveling the speed limit and we're in the middle of an ice storm, that could be, you know, pretty disastrous.
Michael Klaman, what do you know about this?
Yeah, that's one of the biggest problems currently. In fact, I'll tell you, you asked me earlier, you know, what might it take for me to own a driverless car? If it gets to the point where a driverless car, if I can use it to pick up my kids from school during a Wisconsin winter, then I'll be comfortable driving one of these cars. But where it is right now, they have redundant vision systems. It's a combination of LIDAR, radar, sonar, and cameras. Each of those, while it's good to have a big picture with all of those sensors, they all have their weaknesses. And snow is one of the biggest problems. Basically, as it's snowing, it creates basically this opaque sheet in front of the car that one of the systems can't see through. And then, of course, the snow on the ground is going to be covering up the lines that allow the LIDAR to keep the car within its particular lane.
All right. We have to break for news. I'm sorry. We'll continue your point in just a couple of minutes. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. It's our big question debate on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our big question debate today is about driverless cars. Do you think they're a good idea? Be sure to go and participate in our online poll. You can find a link to the poll on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Do you like them or not, or don't you care? My guests are Michael Klaman, senior research scientist at Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. He leads Duke's driverless car research. And Robin Washington, a transportation journalist and columnist whose work appears in the Boston Globe and other publications. His website is robinwashington.com. Michael Klaman, I had to cut you off because we needed to get to a news break, but I wanted you to finish your comments on driverless cars and weather problems, and then, Robin, I want to hear you respond.
Yeah, so what I was saying is that some of these, having the redundant systems doesn't necessarily help in all situations, but there are still some situations where even having the redundant vision systems doesn't help to navigate. And there are some areas where this is being tested, but for the time being, it's still being done on closed courses. For example, at M City up in Michigan by Ford, but not with the same type of situation that you see over in California.
Robin Washington, what about the weather argument? I mean, Wisconsin is a pretty inhospitable place for driving under our winter conditions.
Oh, well, it tests our metal, doesn't it? I mean,
well, yeah, we like to say it keeps the riffraff out, but I mean, if I'm in a driverless car, I need to know that it can handle the weather.
Right, and Mike was totally correct. It can't right now with the snow and fog, I believe, is another problem. I'm looking at the signs here for 30,000 feet, if you will, but so I can't tell exactly what that would be. And if I did know, I'd be out there patenting something and doing a startup. That hasn't been solved. And I suspect that somebody's going to solve it in a way that, you know, usually by accident or something, by looking for something else, because I don't know how any of the traditional methods that Michael mentioned, the sonar, LIDAR, whatever, are going to address that. So somehow I think that will be solved, and I don't think it's going to be solved in a way, again, by directly trying to solve it, if you will. But all that being said, there's so much going into this. You know, I still see that the entire technology is just going to keep careening and happen. I think the regulations is probably the single most important thing that has to happen, though. I'm sort of guessing here because I can't remember exactly what I did, but not long ago I did a search. It was either Massachusetts or Minnesota general laws, and I searched for motor vehicles, and out of 800 pages, it showed up on like 300 or something like that. The percentage was something like that. Please don't hold me to those numbers. But that tells you how much cars have to, you know, are regulated already. So if anyone wants to make a libertarian argument about too much regulation or whatever, they are regulated, and they're regulated for a reason, because this is all about safety. There's regulations as to whether or not your lights should be on or how visible they should be, how many feet ahead. And so all these things have to be looked at if you're totally redoing a car. So, you know, this has to happen. I mean, you know, nothing else to say on that.
All right. We have an email from Ashley that I think gets at a point that might be on a lot of people's minds. Ashley emails, a lot of what some people call efficient, I call lazy. The more we have computers and technology, the less we do. Eventually, I fear we would become obsolete. Well, Michael Klaman, Duke, you're doing research on humans and autonomy. Is this a legitimate fear? If we have too many computers, including the ones that run our cars, are humans just going to become obsolete?
Yeah, this gets into the area that's called automation disruption, the area where, you know, we would all be replaced by computers and not have anything left to do. I think, again, this is an area that we've seen a lot of new books come out on it in the past couple of years. But the whole idea of adding additional automation to these systems is that it frees us up to do other things. It allows us to be more productive in other areas. So it's not so much as an either-or. Either, you know, if the computer does something for you, that means you're suddenly left to do nothing. The idea is that you would then be left to do something more productive and not just sitting around idle.
Well, and one of the things, and we had a caller who dropped off, but a driverless vehicle might give access to the roads to people who don't have them now. Robin Washington, what about somebody who's sight impaired? Would driverless cars be an answer for them?
And so I've done some informal demographic studies, if you will. Millennials, you wouldn't be too surprised, are actually pretty embracing of the idea of driverless cars. They basically want to get somewhere. They are heavy users of public transit already. Baby boomers, not so much so. These are the people who couldn't wait until they were 16 years old to get their license and start having the love affair with the car. But surprisingly, seniors actually are looking forward to it. Why? Because the baby boomers keep taking away their keys. So because of that, you have a whole market. And by the way, the baby boomers, by the time these things get out there, are going to be those seniors, and they won't be able to wait for a driverless car to come pick them up and give them that extra mobility. That actually can argue against that. I think that that would be a wonderful thing.
800-642-1234. We're approaching the time of the hour on the Big Question when we do our sound-off segment. So if you want to call in now, we'll get you in the queue for you to have your say on driverless cars. 800-642-1234. You still have a couple of minutes to vote in our online poll. Well, you know what? We're getting close to the end of our hour here. Let's get each of your closing arguments on self-driving cars. Robin, you started the hour, so Michael, let's hear you first. Will driverless vehicles be good or bad for America, and why?
I think they'll eventually be good for America, but right now I don't think we can make any reliable predictions about when it's going to happen. There are too many technology hurdles, like the sensors, the potential for hacking, the privacy issues of these cars collecting so much data, and the infrastructure changes that would be required. I think for Moody's to suggest this is going to be ready 14 years from now is a bit too aggressive, and I think it's going to take much, much longer.
Robin Washington?
Well, I'm very excited by the push of all the manufacturers to do this for whatever motivation they're doing, if they want to be first or not. But I think what's going to shake out of this is, you know, it's like VHS and beta. Of course, nobody uses any of those anymore. But you didn't use beta for a long, you know, at all. Somebody's going to come up with the standard, and it has to happen. And this is where government has to get involved. I mean, this is the future. It's happening already. These cars basically can do it. They need to have the assistance and the will of the people to let them do it and make them do it in a way that's safe.
Well, I'm not sure you want to make that VHS beta argument, Robin, because beta was clearly not the better format in terms of the technology. It just lost the marketing race. So that doesn't necessarily make us feel comfortable. But
right. And in fact, in the professional beta stayed around much longer. Nobody used the VHS professionally.
Right. And for good reason. You know what? We're going to go to our sound off segment. So I'll say goodbye to my guests. Michael Klaman, senior research scientist at Duke University's Humans and Autonomy Lab. He leads the Duke's driverless car research. Michael, thank you so much for joining us this morning. I appreciate you being on our debate.
Well, thank you. Good to talk to you both.
And Robin Washington, transportation journalist and columnist whose work appears in the Boston Globe and other publications. RobinWashington.com is the website. Robin, thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you, John and Michael.
All right, we're going to our sound-off segment, and the polls are now closed for online voting. Here's the result of our poll. Yes, 28%. 28% of you like the idea of driverless cars. No, 57%. So a clear win for the naysayers, people who don't have – people can still vote. The polls aren't closed. This is what we have so far. Got it. I prematurely closed the polls. Sue me. Middle of the road so far, 14%. So right now the no's have it. Let's go to our sound-off segment, and we'll start in Wausau, and Paul is with us. Paul, what's your take?
Well, I'm in outside sales, and I spend about 15 to 20 hours behind the wheel every week, and I would be able to get a lot more production done if I could follow up on emails and make some phone calls while I was behind the wheel.
All right. Paul, as somebody on the road, he supports driverless cars. I forgot to mention, you have 30 seconds. Paul stayed clearly within the lines there. Let's go to Tom in Richland Center next. Tom, go ahead. 30 seconds.
Hello. Yes, I support driverless cars. And I think driverless cars are an intricate part of the train system. So I think we already have driverless cars, and we should use them more.
All right. Tom supports driverless cars. Thank you. Jack in Milwaukee, you'll be next on our sound-off segment. Jack, go ahead.
the reduction of jobs in America is never a reason to slow down the production, the progress of technology. The Sawyer's Guild lobbied against the creation of sawmills, and if that was successful, we wouldn't have sawmills today. So losing jobs is not an argument not to do driverless cars.
So you're in favor of driverless? All right, that's another yes vote. Let's go to John in Richland Center next. John, good morning.
Good morning. I used to repair mainframe computers for the Federal Reserve Bank downtown Milwaukee, and they always broke. Right now, there's more people killed in car accidents than heart attacks, and I oppose it.
All right. John opposes driverless. 800-642-1234. You can have your 30-second say on driverless cars. 800-642-1234. And you can still vote in our poll. Here's a, I can scroll back up to it here. Here's an email. Lisa emails, the first introduction of a driverless car is terrifying. I'm not against the technology, just people. The Civic you were discussing as an example. Once you introduce even the simplest features, people will be doing all sorts of things in their cars except paying attention. They'll be texting, sleeping, putting on makeup, gaming, or doing work on their computers. Look what they do now when the vehicle is completely dependent on their attention and control. So we're going to put Lisa down as a no. And here's an email from Tim. There still and always will be a large car enthusiast population who drive their cars because they enjoy driving their cars. When I personally hear about driverless cars and pilotless planes, to me it sounds boring, unenjoyable, and takes away the thrill and adventure of setting out on the open road or into the blue sky. The only time I see a driverless car as a potential interest to me is long-distance interstate travel. All right, there you have it. And we're out of time. Thank you so much for participating in our poll. It looks like more people don't like these cars than like them. Thanks to Bill Martins for producing this hour. Elizabeth Deliquist handled on-air production. Christy Taylor did her usual fine job of directing. John Munson in for Joy Cardine. I hope you have a safe commute to work this morning. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.